Merkle Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rockfin, Odyssey, Band.video, Vigilante.tv, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate your support. We couldn't do it without the contributions of our sponsors, which helped keep the program going. Legal Shield is fantastic. They've been in business for 50 years in the United States and Canada. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. And what they do is they bring the collective buying power of all of us, direct it towards high-power law firms in your area so that you get access to an attorney at a very reasonable price. Works out to like a dollar a day, 30 bucks a month will get you in with an attorney that on average has 22 years of experience. So you're not going to get somebody fresh out of law school. These you can use them for a variety of things. I think one of the low-hanging fruits is to get a lot of contractual details taken care of. If you don't have a financial power of attorney or a medical power of attorney, get that taken care of. Last will and testament, we're adults, got to have it. Nobody wants to think about that stuff, but you got to do it. You got to have it, put it in your safe. If you don't, then when you die, the state gets involved in your affairs. Nobody wants that. But look, it's a couple grand for yourself and your spouse to get these documents taken care of. So I think it's a reasonable thing for you to do. If you sign up for this service, you should knock those documents out right away. If your work is asking you to sign some sort of new employment agreement that has something related to, I don't know, a medical directive that you're unfamiliar with, that they want you to do something that's against your will, send it to your attorney. Have them review that. Legal documents, anything before you signed it, you sign it, you send it to your attorney, let them handle it. If you're getting a W-2 audit by the IRS. God knows they want to, you know, they're not going after the billionaires. They're going after waitresses and bartenders, you know, if you don't claim your tips. If you have issues with that, send that to your attorney. We've got a website built for you. If you want to take a look and see if you think it's right for you, www.don'tgetpushedaround.com is the domain. You can take a look. You can see not just the legal plan, but also the ID shield. If you're interested in reputation management or identity protection, things like that, if you run a small business and you are doing well, but you're not big enough to have your own law firm, you can outsource that as well. If you're somebody that carries a gun, they have paperwork for that as well. All kinds of things going on over there. So my suggestion, just go to the website, read up on it, see if it's right for you. The price is right. It's definitely reasonable. The company is legit. They've been around for a long, long time. Don'tgetpushedaround.com is the website. Also, thank you to our newest sponsor. Hopefully you never need them, but EMP Shield is there. They're building a beyond military grade EMP protector that it can be installed not just on your car, your house as well, your boat, if you have an RV, if you have a generator, all of these things are eligible to have EMP shield attached to it. It is fitted to household circuit breakers with just four wires. It installs like a type 2 surge protector. There are installation videos on the website at empshield.com, or you can find them online wherever you get your videos. You can find a way to do this. It will protect against EMPs, solar flares, and lightning strikes. Listen, hopefully you don't need it, but lightning is a real thing that definitely impacts people. So hopefully the Chinese spy balloon doesn't come by with a big EMP attached to it and wipe us all out. But if it does, this is many times more efficient than a single-use military design, and it can withstand up to 40 EMPs. Not that your nerves could handle 40 EMPs, but EMP Shield can. So again, it's an interesting device. Take a look at it. Go to empshield.com. Use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself a little bit of money, and we certainly do appreciate that. Well, now that we've got the business out of the way, we're going to get into a topic that is, we got to have the conversation. It's a polarizing one. It's the new reality. It's talking about what's going on in society with this push towards transgenderism, and then the additional step towards the medical decision making process to transition. It's something that we didn't have to deal with as kids, but now as we get older, and those of us that have parents, it's a real thing. So, it's my pleasure to welcome Simon Essler to the program. He is the director of a new documentary coming out called Cut, Daughters of the West. Simon, how are you, good man? Nice to meet you. Thanks for coming on the show.
I'm doing well, thank you. And I appreciate you having me on board. There's lots to get into with this. It is a really important issue.
I wish we didn't have to. You know, I wish I was having you on to talk about the deep state or something, you know, like that. But instead, what we're talking about is like, well, I don't know. Maybe we're talking about the medical deep state. You know, maybe we're talking about this push to normalize something that, you know, look, when we were kids, it was like there might be a girl in your class that was kind of a tomboy, right? A kind of more predisposed to wearing kind of guys' clothing, or like to go play football, or like to play in the dirt or dig for worms or whatever. You know, I mean, it wasn't a big deal. You maybe as a kid, you didn't notice much about it. You get a little bit older, get into high school. You think, well, maybe that person, I never thought of it. Maybe that person's gay. You know, maybe that person's gay. I grew up in Palm Springs, California, which has a huge gay population. So it was always kind of normalized to me growing up and seeing that. But, you know, again, when you're a kid, you don't really think about these things. But now there is undeniably an agenda that's going on. The push to normalize that everybody's a million different genders, or they're, you know, cake gender today and unicorn gender tomorrow, is, I think it's screwing up a lot of kids' heads. Coupled that with social media and what we've seen, we thought it was bad when our parents put us in front of the television set where we could watch cartoons. You know, now it's like it's TikTok and it's 45 seconds and it's scrambling our brains. I'm curious to know, of all that you're a documentary filmmaker, you've made movies in the past. Why this one? Why did this topic I find it to be fascinating and deeply important, but for you particularly, what brought you to this topic?
Well, you know, before this documentary, I made a six-part docuseries called Superorganism, and it was focused on the war on the family. And when I got into my research on the war on the family, what I found was that, you know, it was genuine warfare, and that there was operations specifically targeting the mother, there were operations specifically targeting the father, and there were operations specifically targeting children. And so in that series, you know, when I was researching what kind of attacks are going on towards the children, I unavoidably came up against gender ideology, because it really read as a warfare operation that was doing very, very serious damage to children. And so I ended up having to go down that rabbit hole in my quest to understand the war on the family unit. And I ended up digging through gender ideology and its roots and how it was being brought into kids' lives. And so after making that series, I ended up with a whole bunch of research that I couldn't even fit into that. And the more deeply I looked into it, the more I started to understand that gender ideology really isn't impacting kids generically as much as it's impacting girls. And that was a big reveal for me, that I had assumed that it was kind of girls and boys equally, and that they're both struggling with the effects of it. And this just isn't true. It is overwhelmingly hurting girls more. And it has surged in girls into a craze. We have what is essentially a social contagion exploding in preteen and teen girls. So, you know, once I found out that that was going on and the severity of it and some of the permanent damage that was being done to these girls, I really felt that I had no choice but to put together a film that would invite people to understand this issue. But what I noticed was that in the pushback against this, there is a trap that's being laid that makes it seem like this is a political issue, like this is left versus right, or that this is gay people versus straight people. And all of that, these are false narratives, and they actually make it more difficult to have meaningful dialogue and to create meaningful change that protects children from this. So at the heart of my intention in making this film was the desire to bring forward evidence and awareness that was apolitical on this issue. And that's exactly what I found when I started digging into some of the social conditioning that was prevalent before gender ideology was inserted. I found that girls were being led down a pretty dark path, regardless of gender ideology, in ways that were apolitical. And so, you know, I've studied warfare for a long time. I've studied modern warfare for a long time. And it looked to me like there were very modern forms of warfare at work, not just in implementing gender ideology into our cultural landscape, but also in stopping us from being able to work together to end something that's hurting kids. And so specifically, polarizing it politically has been one of those tactics. It has stopped people from reaching across the political aisle and saying, wait, let's make this about the kids, not about politics. And so that's at the heart of the film. And a lot of what I've uncovered invites people into that exact understanding of the issue.
Wow. Yeah. And so if it's a war against the family in general and children in particular, there's got to be a general. There's got to be somebody directing this. It doesn't just come out of nowhere, right? It's got to be made to happen. So who's behind this? Who is making this happen? I know that the Pritzker family, a pretty powerful family in Illinois, is deeply involved in financing the trans agenda. Are they, you know, who's behind this this war on, well, war on the family?
Well, I mean, I think that the truth is that you do have an actual deep state that we're confronted by. You do have a shadow government. And the best way to understand that is, you know, to look at the entities that have been in power and have stayed consistent in their agendas throughout political cycles and throughout the changing of political cycles. You know, the media is a really good example of this. The media has been compromised. And so if you look at the corporations that own the handful of mainstream media entities, they have shifted their propaganda left wing to right wing. They all align with whichever political party has allowed them to install a particular narrative. So if we go back in time and we look at, you know, let's say you look at Republican administrations that were involved in implementing war, you know, and you look at administrations like Bush and Cheney, you had the media leading the people into war based on information that was proven to be false. And it ended up sacrificing, you know, soldiers that ended up sacrificing men and women to something that was a lie. And at that time, their allegiance was to the party that was going to help them push forward those narratives. Now we fast forward to where we're at here, and they are aligned with a more left-wing, seemingly a more left-wing agenda. And it is, again, it's based on a false narrative. It's based on false information, and it is to implement this trans ideology and gender ideology in general into our society as a norm. So when you watch over these cycles of time, over decades, and you see that there has been these consistent groups in power, you've seen the media, that they don't actually care about which political wing is correct. They're an apolitical entity that has stayed consistent in their capacity to manipulate the public's capacity to think about things. So to me, that's who we're looking at. We're looking at what has stayed over political cycles. And we could look even deeper and say, you know, what forms of power have stayed over the generations? You know, are there families that have maintained power throughout the generations? And, you know, I studied a document called the Toronto Protocols very, very deeply when I was doing my series Superorganism on the War on the Family. Now, this document, it's based on a series of meetings that were held by a group that called themselves the 666. So they were overtly satanic in how they identified. And the biggest takeaway from this document was that it was literally a warfare strategy of how to implement a new world order. And so, you know, and I think when people look at this document, it is important that, you know, we don't use belief. We don't just believe it right away. People should be absolutely skeptical of these things. But what happens when you read this document is that you look at the warfare strategy that they're laying out, and then you look at the world today, and it 100% matches what they were talking about in these two meetings in the 60s and in the 80s. So the question you have to ask is, why does the state of the world today match these warfare documents and their stated intentions with such incredible precision? They talked about legalizing various forms of homosexuality to undermine the legal system and to create the rights of the individual as something that would squash democratic rights. They talk about taking feminism to its logical extreme to remove the mother from the family. I mean, they're very articulate in the way they speak to this. They talk about sexualizing children too early to damage them so that they're not able to navigate the world sexually as adults. So, you know, it's important. It's important that we look at these things and that we step back and we recognize that, yes, maybe we shouldn't believe everything. And you do want to be mindful of belief in general. But then again, we are surrounded clearly by these forms of warfare that were described decades ago. And so, you know, that was a foundation I was working off of. And when I went to make this film, I didn't want to bring any of that deep conspiratorial material. I wanted to say, okay, just look, let's look at the culture of cosmetic surgery. And let's see what was happening before the trans craze. And what was happening was that teenage girls at an exponentially rising rate, we're getting breast augmentations and labiaplasties, which is cosmetic genital surgery. And you had teens going to their gynecologists, going to their parents, begging for cosmetic genital surgery. And so this is rising. And then you insert gender ideology. And so the two of them have actually been going up together. So what was happening to the daughters of the West all along, all these years, what was occurring in our culture so that they were actually taking in the message that their body is an obstacle to who they are, because that's the foundational message that they've been given. So whether they're getting the breast augmentation or the labiaplasties, or they're saying, I'm a boy, and they're getting a double mastectomy and removing their breasts, all of it is based on the same messaging. And so I think that's the point. You see these consistent messaging systems that have been occurring. And it doesn't matter whether we've had a left-wing or right-wing push that's originating, or that those seem to be originating from. What matters is those long-term cycles that have created the conditions we're faced with today. And that, to me, is an invitation to say, hey, this isn't left versus right. There's a dialogue to have here about what has been happening to girls for a long time.
Yeah, and your Toronto document reminds me of an interview I have that's available everywhere. If you type in Tom DeLay, I think it's 2016, maybe 2015, 12 perversions. He's on an interview with C-SPAN, and he says, you know, he was like House Majority Leader of the Republicans, or I don't know, for in 10 years ago or so. And he said, I've been in the meetings where they give us they're giving us the documents to say that they want to normalize 12 perversions, including pedophilia and bestiality, right? And so he's doing this interview in 2015, and they're, you know, get out of here. That's crazy, right? Well, I'd love to see the document, because I think a lot of this, it looks like it has unfolded in a way that maybe he was sitting in on a meeting that that the rest of us weren't. And maybe this is part of an agenda. And it does seem a little choreographed. And it did kind of come out of seemingly out of nowhere. And then, and like as David Icke says, you know, how can you tell when it's the agenda? When it was nowhere, and then all of a sudden it's everywhere, you know, and that feels very inorganic and inauthentic. You know, it feels like it's being made to happen. I'm wondering though, like we know the media. I mean, they're diabolical on a variety of levels, but this push to elevate certain ideas, people, and you know, my mind automatically goes to, and I'm not trying to hang this all on them, but it goes to the Kardashians, okay? Just this real superficial, the normalization of superficiality, the normalization of like everybody is selfie and, you know, you got to, you know, you're touching up your selfies before you post them, and this unattainable beauty status that's being created. You know, let's not forget about Bruce Jenner transitioning to Caitlyn Jenner. That was the first time I think the broader America saw that in a normalized, I mean, as normalized as you can get, I guess. When you watch a Olympic decathlon gold medal winner turn into a woman right before your eyes, right? So it was weird, but it was brewing. And I wonder, like, I know we can't point the finger at anyone, but like who's to blame in this whole thing? I mean, the Kardashians, it feels so, they feel like if this were a trial, they'd have to be put on the witness stand, right? For something like this. Is this pop culture to its most diabolical degree?
Well, I think there's two things going on. Yes, you do have groups and people who are responsible for this kind of influence. And yet at the same time, we are collectively responsible for participating in the normalization of a lot of these things. There's a balance we need to have between holding entities accountable for their participation in what's going on and taking collective responsibility for what we have allowed by not being cognizant enough of, you know, our own participation. You know, it's like you have to start with where in my being does this social engineering exist? Because the only way things get normalized is through collective creation, collective participation. So, you know, to the extent that we did not in ourselves fight for free thought, okay? And this is something that I like to define for people very carefully. Free thought is best defined as the ability to produce thoughts through empiricism, which is direct personal experience, and then you take empiricism and you use logic and reason without the utilization of dogma, authority, or tradition. Now, when you put that formula together, what we're dealing with is the ability to produce thoughts that are free of a lot of the social engineering that is going on. And did we value that correctly within the culture that we were all participating in all along? You know, like when we look at participating in social media, all of us, when social media was born, we all signed up. We submitted to giving up our data, giving up our privacy because we wanted more connection. And, you know, we were sort of cornered because it was a technology that we needed. But there's a lot of moments in history where we really didn't properly acknowledge the implications of our choices. And so some of this is just the human race being so immature and having to go through these deep, deep struggles to reach maturity. And I think part of this is that it's like the human awakening is kind of ugly and difficult because it takes deep struggle to find the meaning necessary to awaken. And so the maturity comes in two forms. Number one, it comes from taking personal responsibility for how you participated in this collective creation. But number two, it comes with using our social structures to hold these people accountable. And that's a very important part of this. You're right that there are individuals that need to be held accountable for their influence in all of this. You know, one of the people that I interview in the film, Ryan Heath of the Gavel Project. And the Gavel Project is a nonprofit legal organization that is actually suing people who participated in transitioning girls and ruining their lives with gender ideology. So he is going individual by individual and holding people accountable. He's suing individual teachers, judges, people running foster homes. He is actually holding people accountable. And that is the flip side of this. So we need to have both. We need to have this personal accountability, but then we also need to use things like the justice system to really say, you know what? You may have been ideologically captured, but you still ruined this girl's life, and now you need to be held accountable for it. And so I think that that is the way to move forward with collective maturity. We need to find that balance. It's really important.
It really is. And I've been critical of the media for a lot of things, and I think rightly so. But I also reserve a portion of my criticism for the general public too. Like you have a responsibility to acknowledge that, you know, not just take somebody's word for it over there at MSNBC or CNN or Fox News that they're telling you. Like you have you're a participant in this information gathering process too, as much as you can be. So the parents that go along with this, I wonder, are we in this weird world where parents are feeling almost social pressure to conform, or they're maybe even, you know, getting their social credit scores up by saying, look how stunning and brave I am for acknowledging that my daughter here, who's 9, is ready to transition. And isn't she amazing? And by default, aren't I amazing? So are we talking about this being a sort of, I don't know if mental illness is the best way, but almost like a social peer pressure on for the parents as well, that are almost, if not forcing this, definitely in some cases encouraging and supporting this, what normally would be thought of as insanity, right?
Yes. You have this, actually, it's a really tangled web of what's going on with the parents. And I would sort of look at it from two different lenses. On the one hand, you definitely do have parents who are not only ideologically captured, but they are corrupt in the sense that they're using this to virtue signal, and they are willing to sacrifice their children for, like you said, social credit. And so we do have an element of that going on. And I would say that that ties to the more long-term war on the family, where children are really not honored and cared for in the way that they should be. They're not seen for what they truly are. They're not framed within our society so that they are respected for the role they play, because I believe that children hold within them a space to generate new wisdom for the human race. That space is their innocence. It needs to be protected so that their innocence can give the human race the new knowledge that we need. So they have this ability to take the knowledge from the past and say, hey, what's still relevant from that old wisdom? And how does it need to be changed for today and for tomorrow? So that is the role in our social structure that children play. And so in this war on the family, you have this war on innocence. And so because of that element of the warfare, you have a lot of parents who are not capable of honoring and protecting children's innocence. And so they are willing, because of their blindness to that, they are willing to sacrifice their children to this. And if you go further back, that is likely because these parents, they are detached from their own innocence and they have their own trauma. So if an adult doesn't have a connection with their own inner child, then they are much more likely to harm the innocence of their own children. And that's when you can look back generationally over the trauma that's been passed through the generations. The other way of looking at this is a more compassionate view of the parents, because we have some very, very serious information warfare being waged so that even parents who are seeking out alternative information to understand what's happening to their child, they're not able to access it, and they're doing their best with the disinformation that they have been saturated by. So I'll give people an example. You know, you may have a parent who their child comes home from school one day and says, I'm a boy. So their daughter arrives home, says, I'm a boy. I identify as a boy. I want you to call me Tim now. I want you to use new pronouns. And the parents don't really know what to do with this. Now, the parents, you know, they may go to the doctor, and the doctor, having been ideologically captured by our institutions, is going to likely say, you need to perform affirmative care. Okay, so gender affirmative care is your only choice. And if you don't perform gender affirmative care with your child, they're likely going to kill themselves. And this is what a lot of the doctors are saying. So we have their emotional blackmail. Now, let's say the parent questions even that. And they go to try to do some research and they stumble across an article by, Scientific American. Now, Scientific American, they have these articles that say, you know, that this is the end of the debate on gender affirmative care for children. And they go and they cite 30 different studies and institutions, all of which happen to be American. None of them are from anywhere else in the world. But of course, the parent doesn't see the relevance of that. They don't understand what has been censored from their newsfeed. They don't get that what's true is that Norway, Sweden, the UK have all ended gender affirmative care. Not only have they ended it, but you know, you have the example of the UK, the Tavistock Institute. They ended it after a review of their application of the gender affirmative model. They found that, number one, they were copying the American model. So that they say that was our first mistake. Number two, they found out that this model of gender affirmative care has nothing to back it. And number three, that it's genuinely permanently damaging children. So they went the opposite direction. And not only did they say we're not going to use the gender affirmative model in terms of medicalizing children, they actually say that socially transitioning children is a severe psychosocial act with potential long-term damage. So they don't even support socially transitioning children. But if you go back to this parent, this loving parent, who's just been told that the child is on the verge of suicide, it is their love that is being manipulated through information warfare. And so you want to balance our view of like, yes, sometimes it's parents who are virtue signaling because they have their own traumas. And sometimes it's a parent's love that's being manipulated. And if they had access to better information, they would take better action. And it's hard to know when which is why we need to be peaceful in our approach to communicating about this issue. You can't always assume that a parent is a traumatized child abuser. You don't really know what is their information bubble that they might be trapped in. What is their newsfeed curated to make them believe?
Well, this concept hits home for me. I have an 11-year-old daughter who has never expressed any sort of interest in transitioning or anything like that. But again, I work in this field. I see what's going on. I worry about it. I worry about peer pressure. I wonder about, you know, it's tough to be a kid. You know, you want to fit in and you know, sometimes it's, you have to have the right sort of athletic shoes, you know, and then you're cool. Or if you don't, oh, you get mocked, you know. Now it's like, are you one of the cool kids who's using they, them pronouns or, you know, whatever. And this sort of social peer pressure, even under the best of circumstances, is tough to deal with. And it's very real. But then when you take a potentially confused kid who, like you said, maybe comes from a home where there has been a quiet war on their parents' minds for 40 years that they aren't even aware of. Maybe both parents are out of the home working. Maybe they're divorced. Maybe there's something going on and this kid is feeling less than. And here's a group that forms that is accepting of all sorts of unusual kids. Maybe you're a dorky kid. Maybe you're an introvert. Maybe you're an artistic kid that doesn't fit in and play and doesn't want to play sports at recess, you know, and you feel isolated and on the outside. It seems to me like there's this social pressure that's happening among their peers in the schools. That's my assumption. I believe that that's probably happening. But in your research, have you found like when that begins? Because I mean, obviously high school is rough, but now you start going, no, this is happening way earlier than high school. Is it not?
Absolutely. Yes. I get into this extensively in the film. So what we're looking at is what's called a social contagion. Now, there has been extensive warfare in the media to erase any discussion about this being a social contagion. And I address that as well in the film, but we do actually have markers for the conditions that created this explosion. And it lines up with three things: smartphones, social media, and a massive crash in teenage girls' mental health. And so those things all coincide. You literally have the release of the smartphone, of the iPhone itself. And, you know, when the iPhone is first released, it's more expensive. It's not necessarily accessible to teenage girls. So we're looking at literally when one of the later iPhones came out, the prices went down, it became more accessible, more children started getting it. And then what we have is social media and smartphones being given to girls that are in middle school. Okay. We had never, ever given middle school children social media and smartphones before. That was a completely new human experiment. And what happens in the data, in the research, is that the mental health of girls went into a crisis. We have preteens being hospitalized for cutting themselves at huge increases. I think it's something like 160%. Like, it's a massive rise in preteen girls cutting themselves. And that group of girls, they didn't cut themselves before. That wasn't a thing. And so you look at all of those things, and then you look at the fact that social media has been a channel for gender ideology to saturate the world of these girls. All of those things create this perfect storm where you then have a social contagion that affects them. And what's interesting is that social media affects girls way more than boys because of the psychological makeup of girls, because they internalized their stress and because they rely more on peer connections for developing their identity and connecting with other girls in ways that boys don't. Then social media, when they're in middle school, it caused them to behave so differently, and it caused their sense of themselves in the embodied sense of self and their idea of their bodies to be deeply warped. So they started seeing all these girls with filters and these celebrities on social media, and it really, really deeply warped them. And it warped them in two ways. And we see this in the research in my film. Either they go along with the Kim Kardashians and they start to want the breast augmentations and the labiaplasties, or they are terrified by this hypersexual image of womanhood. And as they approach the precipice of puberty, they decide that if they can avoid puberty, they can avoid becoming this hypersexual being. And they are told, when they have those sensations and those ideas, they are told, oh, that means that you're a boy. That means that you're a boy trapped in a girl's body, but don't worry, we can help you with that. And we'll provide you with an escape from puberty so that you don't have to become this hypersexual woman. It's okay, we'll protect you. And so they fall for that because they're very, very vulnerable at this time in their lives. And so, you know, this has impacted girls in such a way that, they're not seeking to actually be boys. The research doesn't show that they're trying to be boys. They're just trying to not be girls. So they actually become more non-binary, right? So they're not taking up things that boys like and do. They're not joining into men's culture and seeking out masculine things to do. It's not that. It's a total avoidance of womanhood itself.
Wow. That is really interesting. Let's talk about puberty blockers and hormone therapy, because this is something that is being sold to the general public as, don't worry, it's reversible. If we get down this path and, you know, and you don't like, keep the receipt. If you don't like it, we can exchange it for something that works better. I do not think that that is the truth. I think that the science has proven that coming off of puberty blockers and sort of going back to the way it used to be, I don't think that that is as possible as maybe they sell it to these kids. What did you find about the role, the damage, and sort of the availability of puberty blockers in a way that when we were growing up, it was never even a term?
You know, this was a rabbit hole I got into, and it ended up being so big, I've had to put it aside for the second volume of Cut, because I couldn't even fit the puberty blockers rabbit hole into the film. Essentially, again, we're looking at what seems to be warfare that was very long-term. The way they got puberty blockers onto the scene was by citing something called precocious puberty. So you can go back many, many years, and It's another example of parents being manipulated. They essentially started saying that, you know, your child might be going through puberty too early. It might be precocious puberty. And the two worst things that they seem to be citing from precocious puberty is your child's growth could be stunted if they go through puberty too early, and they could be ostracized by their peers because they're going through puberty while no one else is. So they told parents, like, you don't want your child to be short and you don't want them to get bullied. We're going to put them on Lupron. We're going to block their puberty till later. Now, this is how they got it approved by the FDA, just for precocious puberty. And to this day, it is still only approved by the FDA for precocious puberty. It is not approved for gender dysphoria. So it's being used outside of the context in which it was approved by the medical community. That being said, Lupron is actually the drug that is used to chemically castrate sex offenders. This is what is given to pedophiles to stop them from being able to sexually abuse children. So there's been a long cover-up here. Since that implementation of puberty blockers for precocious puberty, there have been doctors that have tried to speak out. They have been silenced. They have had their medical license taken away. They have been censored. That is all way before gender ideology went mainstream. So we can see, again, the conditions for this, the foundation for this goes back quite a ways. And I think it's important that people understand how these things are implemented and how invisible it is to us when something is implemented a generation ago. That's it's a very subversive kind of warfare. So that if it was normalized a generation ago, we don't know to question it. We're like, puberty blockers are already on, they're already on the market. And a lot of the people who are caught up by this, they're like, look, there's decades of research on giving children puberty blockers. Come on. You know, to them, they're like, this is old hat. What are you talking about? And so they have seemingly a body of evidence to refer to. And if you don't dig deeper, you don't really understanding how surreptitious the insertion of this drug was onto the market for children.
Well, let's talk about that then. Let's talk about the money, because this is a big business. And I've seen the maps that show gender clinics in America in 2010 and gender clinics in America in 2022. And the map has like two dots, LA, New York early on. And then it has like 300 dots, you know, a couple years later. So clearly there's money in this. What are the insurance companies paying for this? Is this clearly the doctors have found a way to you know, a whole new industry, frankly, and a lot of money behind it. Who's driving the bus here with regard to the money flowing into this? And and how much money are we talking about? What sort of an industry is this? Clearly, it's growing, but what are the billions. Numbers look like?
I mean, we're looking at $1 billion industry. You're looking at potentially one child who is medically transitioned producing millions of dollars for the industry over a lifetime. Because what happens is the child becomes medically dependent for life. Okay, this doesn't end. Once they are medically transitioned, they need constant intervention until they die. And actually, it's the intervention in the end that will probably kill them, because the side effects are so severe when, you know, you go on testosterone injections for the rest of your life. So we are looking at the pharmaceutical industry making billions and billions of dollars here. Sometimes you have insurance companies participating. You also have a government element of it, where the government is trying to fund this. You have the military paying for transitions. That's part of what's going on here in Canada. Justin Trudeau has just announced that federal employees who want to transition will get $75,000 from the government to transition. So some of this is being footed by the taxpayers. And some of it, at any given time, if you go on GoFundMe, you will find thousands and thousands of girls trying to raise money for their double mastectomies. You can look it up right now. So there are girls desperately seeking donations to go and get the surgery to have their healthy breasts removed from their body. So there is a ton of money in this. And it is coming you know, it's being purged from all angles. So I would say we definitely have the pharmaceutical industry benefiting from this, and surgeons themselves as well. And I would say that the morality of the cosmetic surgery culture has been very dark for a long time. And this is something I get into extensively in my film, that there has been a push by the cosmetic surgery industry to get access to children's bodies and to make money off of them, and to do so at the detriment of the family unit. You know, there's a paper that I found by the largest cosmetic surgery journal in the world. And in the paper, they are complaining. They're essentially expressing their frustration at parents who will not consent to their daughters getting labiaplasties, and essentially saying that, yes, you may get pushback from the parents, but your allegiance is to the patient. If that girl wants a labiaplasty, you side with her. So that's not a left-wing ideology. That's something that was well installed in our society before all of this. And so they make a lot of money, you know, when they modify children's bodies and make these permanent alterations to developing girls, you know, they make a ton of money. And, you know, if you look at the way that gender affirmative care, they support these interventions that end up being very permanent. And they're especially damaging because girls' bodies are changing. They're changing so rapidly, so much. And when you try to make a permanent change to a body that's in flux, you cause a lot of complications. Well, this is true of the breast augmentations and of the labiaplasty as well. You know, one of the weird fixations that it's causing in girls is the size of their labia minora versus their labia majora. And there's this like weird fixation on getting the proportions right between those two. And there is nothing in these cosmetic surgery journals talking about what it means to alter a teenage girl's labia when it's well known that these change over a lifetime, that when she goes from being a girl to a woman, the shape and size of these things change. So to make a panicky decision because you're a young girl who's seen a lot of porn and you want to look like all the naked women you've seen in this porn, or whatever the influence is, she's trying to make a permanent change to a body that is already going to change and develop. So her insecurity isn't even based on where her body is going to end up. And so that's true, both in the gender ideology space and in the cosmetic surgery space that's not saturated by that. So I would say that the surgeons are making a ton of money off of all of this.
You can't rent a car in America unless you're 25 years old, because they don't think that your brain hasn't fully developed, and they don't want to be on the hook if you, you know, act irresponsibly because you're just a little bit younger and you're not thinking clearly. You have to be 21 to drink alcohol here. You have to be 18 to buy cigarettes. You have to be 18 to get into the military. Why is it okay to be 11 years old? I mean, when you're 6 years old, you know, I wanted to be Aquaman. And like, it's crazy to me that we're going, yeah, all those things are true, but let's throw that out when it comes to an 11-year-old who automatically just all of a sudden decides they want to be a different gender. Yes, I understand that she's not eligible to you know, rent a car for the next 14 years because her brain is still developing, but it's developed enough to make this life-altering, permanent decision. And anybody that questions that, well, then you're just a transphobe, a bigot, probably a Trump supporter, you know, all the things that come out where it starts to get personal, it starts to get ideologically based, all these criticisms. And it's like, no, even if I were all those things, what difference does it make? The question remains, why are we transitioning 11-year-olds, and who thought this is a good idea?
You know, there's a 1984 interview with a man named Yuri Bezmenov.
I've been all over, right? Yuri lately, man. I have... Okay.
So this is really
an article out that's a video out that said Yuri, it just called Yuri was right. You know, yes. That's all it was. Yeah.
Okay. So there's something interesting to unpack about what Yuri says in that interview, because he talks about basically people who are so ideologically captured that they cannot see that black is black and white is white, that even if you give them authentic, true information, they cannot see it. And that is this communist style warfare that was going to be implemented. It was going to be implemented slowly over multiple generations. So what happens is when you implement something, when you normalize something over many generations, it becomes autogenic, right? It becomes something that operates within people naturally without their conscious awareness. This is something that MKUltra whistleblower Kathy O'Brien talks about,
right?
That when pedophilia, when child abuse occurs over 2 to 3 family generations, there is an autogenic effect where that child is, they're available to forms of mind control automatically in a way that they have no conscious awareness of. So when you go back to what Yuri Bezmenov is talking about here, with people being so ideologically captured because of these generations of social conditioning and warfare, then you have people like this who, even though you're like, hey, look at all the things they can't do at this age, what about this? They can't see that black is black and white is white. But we have the opportunity here to look at something exceptional to Yuri Bezmenov's rule. And this is one of the things I focused on in my film. You have detransitioners, okay? And they are an exception to what Yuri Bezmenov talked about, because they were so ideologically captured that they could not see that black was black and white was white, to the extent that they permanently damaged their own bodies. But the trauma of that and the conditions of their life path actually had them wake up out of it. And now, even though they were captured ideologically, they can see the authentic information and they are trying to speak out. We actually, March 12th was Detrans Awareness Day, and a lot of the detransitioners got together. People should look up that hashtag, because they are an exception to the mind control that has enabled all of this to happen. And so lifting up their voices, that takes something that, you know, Yuri Bezmenov was generally right. It is true that overall that is the case, but the fact that they are an exception to that and they've woken up out of it means they have the experience of actually waking up out of that totally illogical state and seeing reality again, and now trying to be like, hey, look, I was captured. I was mind control, and I cut off my healthy breasts. I sterilized myself, and I want people to hear my story. I see the truth now. So I think, you know, in the film, what I did was I tried to gather as many poignant moments of the messaging from the detransitioners as I could find across the internet, because a lot of them are speaking out, and I gathered all that up and I wove it into the film to try to create an impact from their voices so that we can see what is coming from the genuine human beings that woke up out of this. And I think if they can emerge from it, then potentially their story can help some of these people who can't see the illogical nature of all of this. I think it will actually help wake some people up. So sharing their voices, I think, is kind of like, you know, if we're looking at this from a warfare perspective, it's like throwing a grenade. It's just like it's explosive. It can actually awaken people. And it's really important to side with them and to follow their work right now.
I would imagine that pool of detransitioners is only growing at this mm-hmm. point, right? As we start to get down this path where you're now a couple years into this process, you've been down it, you've transitioned, you've gone through things, maybe you've, as you mentioned, your body is kind of supposed to be evolving. Maybe it is still evolving. I don't know how much damage is done by these puberty blockers, but theoretically, you're still evolving. Definitely, I would think your mind is evolving. Maybe even the drugs itself are causing you to question everything. That pool of detransitioners, people that are, you know, 7 years into this process and go, I've made a catastrophic mistake. I see some of those. I see some of those on Twitter. I see the videos that they'll put up of them. It's heartbreaking. You know, you feel so bad. You feel like, boy, these people were duped. They walked into a trap that they didn't understand. They made a permanent decision on a temporary feeling. They're sterilized for life. Now, what are we talking about in terms, I'm just curious, in terms of like the industry itself, how many children are starting this process of transitioning? I mean, what are we talking?
Thousands. You can go to the D-Trans Reddit forum, and this is all, you know, girls and boys, but mostly girls trying to create a community and to talk to each other about the detrans process, it is now in the tens and tens of thousands. It's a huge number. And one of the issues that we have is that it is very, very difficult for these girls to speak out because number one, their community that once welcomed them and celebrated them will turn on them on a dime. Yeah. We'll say, you are a traitor. You're now a transphobe. You're disgusting. You disgust us. We hate you. So they're up against that. And they're also up against the attacks by the media. You know, Chloe Cole has been a big voice. Mm-hmm. She has been attacked by the media. She's had hit pieces written on her. You have that. And you just also have overt censorship. There have been detransitioners who, before Elon Musk took over Twitter, they were just ripping their tweets down. With no warning, no notification, just them like saying the horror story that is their bodily daily experience now, and the tweets just disappearing from the internet. So they're up against a lot. Not only do they now have to heal from the trauma of their mistake, but even if they want to share it, they're up against this huge machine that's going to make that very difficult for them. And so I think, you know, we're dealing with a lot of quiet suffering right now. And the fallout, we haven't even seen the beginning of it. Not even the beginning.
It's heartbreaking. It really is. That, you know, look, if you're an adult and you want to make these decisions, go for it, I guess. It wouldn't be high on my list of things that I would enthusiastically support. But if you're an adult and you want to do it, fine. I think most of us have righteous anger because it's happening towards kids. I'm wondering, maybe we'll wrap up with this. Obviously, everyone is going to need to see your movie. I'm going to put links in the description where they can find it. But let's talk about some solutions. If you're someone like me that has a child that's in this age range, or if you're somebody that has kids that are eventually going to get to this age range, we have to be prepared with the information because we know it's an information war. We need to be prepared for how we're, what sort of questions we should be asking, what sort of language we should be looking out for, what words we think mean one thing, but maybe they actually mean something else. Can you give us some ideas on where we can really go to educate ourselves so that we are not unarmed when it comes to having this discussion with people that are trying to push this?
So if you go to daughtersofthewestfilm.com, you'll see that I have built a resources section. And so now it's about 25 different links to all sorts of different resources to navigate this warfare. So that is access to therapists who are not going to push the gender affirmative model. So a network of therapists, it's not just offering therapy, but offering publications, parents' guides to mental health that don't include gender ideology. You're going to find access to kids' books that not only have avoided putting gender ideology in the contents, but are books that encourage children to love the body that they're in, to honor and appreciate the body that they're in, to relate their identity to the body that they're in. You're going to find parents who have lost their children to gender ideology, who have now formed a community, who are now researching and sharing and trying to save other families from what they've gone through. You're going to find legal resources if your child has suffered from this to be able to fight back legally. So it's become a huge list of different things that people can access so that they can arm themselves or so that they can just share that with someone they know who's been affected by this. And I'm going to continue to grow that list. I'm finding more and more things all the time. It's a big part. It's the only reason I made this film was to save girls. That is the one thing. And, you know, to the extent that I can do that, you know, I will be very happy to save even just two girls. Like, it doesn't matter if I can do that. And so, you know, getting this film in front of people, it will arm them with the information to be able to talk about this issue without those political traps. Because if you can point to the rise in labiaplasties and breast augmentation and see that it's running parallel with gender ideology, then you can have a conversation about what is happening to all of the girls growing up in our society. So everything that I'm building on that website is to support people in fighting back and protecting their families, or if they have been wounded by this, in healing from those wounds and trying to come back from it and turning that pain into purpose.
I wish we didn't have to have this conversation. You know, I'd much rather be talking about the dangers of central banking, you know, yeah. But again, this is the reality. It's a minefield that we didn't have to navigate when we were kids, but now we've got a new generation of children coming up, and this is, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, we have to get honest. We have to say this is happening. When we drop off our kids at school, there's a lot going on that's beyond reading, writing, and arithmetic, and there's some social pressure and conditioning that's happening here, and it's frustrating and it's very scary. But I'll tell you what, I would much rather be aware of it than and know what I'm up against to the extent that I could, than to bury my head in the sand and pretend like it's not there, because it's clearly there, and it's and it feels like an agenda, probably because it is an agenda, and it's happening and it's measurable, and it's not all in our minds, and we're not conspiracy theorists. We see this happening everywhere. And look, I appreciate you doing this film. I'm excited to check it out because I have to. It's my duty and obligation to know what we're up against. I want to make sure that when I speak on these topics, that I'm as educated about them as I can be. And to be clear, I'm not yet, but I'm working on it and I appreciate it. Where's the best place for people to find you, to support your work, and to get access to this film?
Okay, so the film itself is currently on pre-order at daughtersofthewestfilm.com. So people can go and they can support me by pre-ordering the film now. If you sign up for the email list, on that website, it will give you a discount and other ways to access the film. And also, so I'm doing some giveaways with other film work that I'm doing to encourage people to join up with this battle now, to help me get this into the world now. The film itself will be released on April 15th. We are doing a world premiere at a theater in Arizona on the 15th. We're also doing that as a fundraiser for the Gavel Project, to help raise funds for them to fight back legally to get justice for Sage, who's the girl that's talked about in the movie. She's one of these girls that was caught up in this and was deeply harmed by it. So we're actually doing some giveaways that include VIP tickets to the world premiere in Arizona. So that's another reason to join up. If people also go to www.simonessler.com, you can find all of my work and all the different ways to support me. In terms of social media, I will say that I'm most active on Instagram, and I'm actually part of a larger network that people should know about, which is the Mom Army and the Dad Army. We are a coalition of different organizations and parents who are fighting against the war on innocence. We are taking real world action. We are fighting to get legislation moved forward. We are fighting legally. We are networking to take as much local action as we can. So I encourage people to go to mom-army.com, the mom-army.com, and follow Mom Army and Dad Army on Instagram. Join us. And it's not, some of the people that work with us are not parents, and they are just a part of our organization. We have members across the political spectrum. We are not a right or left wing endeavor. Come join the battle. I'm highly censored, so anytime people want to come and find me on social media and share my work, that's helpful. You know, we've had the trailer get censored a lot. The website itself, daughtersofthewestfilm.com, has a link for you to download the trailer. If you want to share that on your social media and help us out, that's something you can do as well, if you want to take action and help get the film out there and help me get this to the world.
Watch the trailer. Just watch the trailer, and after that, you decide. I think you'll be in. Simon, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you giving us the information about what we're up against, and it's powerful stuff. It's really scary, but we're not going to just give in to this. We're going to fight. So thank you for everything that you're doing.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And if you like this episode, or if there is somebody in your life that you think would benefit from watching this movie, please take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family. You can go to my website, The Octopus of Global Control, if you want to contact me, or you can find me on Twitter @macroaggression. Thanks, everybody. I'll talk to you soon.